a lot of data. You will really bound to find something that this should be verified.
And Arthur Rodin is going to tell us about non-Gaussianity from non-equilibrium physics.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I wanted to first thank Andrew and other organizers for inviting me here to this opportunity to speak, and then I will follow that with another familiar apology that this has very little to do with distant holography. So, what I'm going to be talking about is calculations of non-Gaussianity, in particular in cases where there are some non-equilibrium phenomena happening, and there is a perhaps a connection with the theme of this conference, because you could, and I'm hoping to be able to apply similar techniques also to, for instance, the ekbiotic bounds and this kind of phenomena, non-equilibrium phenomena that have been discussed here at this meeting. This talk, so even though it doesn't have much to do with holography, it actually follows quite nicely this morning's first talk, because the methods are quite similar. So I'm also using field theory simulations to calculate these things, but the focus of the physics that I'm looking at is a bit different. So I'm basically trying to calculate curvature perturbations produced in the early universe. And so just to start with review, which I'm sure everyone here is familiar with, the fact that we have the cosmic microwave background. We see fluctuations in the temperature order 10 to minus 5, and these correspond to curvature perturbations in the early universe, the surface of light scattering. And so we know that there is perturbations with this amplitude. And they seem to be nearly scale invariant, and also they're Gaussian, as far as you can see at the moment. But the if it just had scale invariant and Gaussian perturbations, you wouldn't really learn much from them. So obviously, the interesting thing is deviations from these, whether we can observe, we are now starting to see deviation from scale invariance, and we're hoping in the near future to see deviation from Gaussianity, so non-Gaussian features in the CMB. And people have studied potential non-Gaussianity a lot, and the perhaps simplest way to parameterize it, and what observers like to use to present their results, is in terms of parameter known as F and L. And strictly speaking, it corresponds to a certain particular type of non-Gaussianity, local non-Gaussianity, where the curvature perturbation that we see is a nonlinear function of some Gaussian random variable zeta naught in such a way that the theta expansion and F and L is the coefficient of the quadratic term. And one can generalize this definition by basically writing down what this would predict or what this would give for the three-point function, because obviously if you have Gaussian random variable here, it doesn't have a three-point function, so you can just from this you can calculate what the three-point function is in terms of the two-point function of the power spectrum, and you find this form, and you can then take this as the definition of F and L. So if you can measure a three-point function and the two-point function, you just take the ratio, and that would give you F and L. Of course, defined that way, it depends on the wave numbers. it depends on the scale at which you are looking at it, but in many cases the dependence is quite mild. So you can still, even if you do this, you can at least at the level of order of magnitude estimates, you can still compare your result with the number that the observers give. Now, for single field inflation, one doesn't really get any non-Gaussianity because it's suppressed by the Slorov parameters. Therefore, it's generally less than one. And because of that, it is very interesting that observations actually seem to give us a hint for level of non-Gaussianity that's much higher than that. So at 2 sigma level, WMAP satellite measurements, the WMAP team's own analysis said that FNL is between -9 and 111, and other studies are basically giving similar bounds. And so basically, yeah, of course, it is still consistent with zero, but it means that the data sort of seems to favor FNL of something like 50 or perhaps a little bit under that, but it seems to favor a non-zero FNL. And in particular, it seems to favor an FNL which is much bigger than what you get from single field inflation. And so obviously, if you could, if you really find this, the Planck satellite will measure FNL to much higher accuracy than this. And if it really finds that it's FNL, then it's going to be very exciting because it will mean that you can't just have single field in slow roll inflation, but we need something more complicated than that. Right, so yeah, don't really have to go through this, but so I am working in the context of inflationary models. Could basically apply this same kind of method to other, for instance, the ekpyrotic case, but what I'm going to be talking now is all applied really to inflation. And so we have a scalar field phi, which dominates during inflation. The potential term dominates energy density during inflation. And the slow roll parameters are much less than one. And then you find that the Hubble rate is approximately constant, and therefore you get approximately exponentially accelerating solution. And that solves the horizontal flatness problem. The way you get the curvature perturbations in a single field inflationary model is that you have quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field, and you can write down the equation of motion, linearized equation of motion for them, and it's in this form. And you find that the modes that are outside the horizon, so when k, basically, slow roll conditions tell you that this parameter, the curvature, the potential is very small, and therefore, if your mode is outside the horizon, this term is much smaller than that, and you have an overdamped oscillator, and therefore, your mode is frozen. And from that, you can calculate the power spectrum for the field fluctuations, the two-point function, normalized in this way, has value h squared over 2 a cubed. And from that, you can find the power spectrum as it's normally given as a contribution from a logarithmic scale in k, and it's more or less constant h squared over 4 pi squared. And if it was just a constant, this would be a scale invariant spectrum. So this gives the amplitude of the fluctuations of the field, and then from that you can calculate the curvature perturbation. And I will just go through that calculation in the so-called separate universe formalism, because that's what I will be using later in a more complicated case, which is sort of an introduction to see how you get from the field perturbation, which we had here, to the curvature perturbation. And so the idea in the separate universe picture is that if you look at very long length scales, much bigger than the horizon size at that time, and then different points, the points that are separated by much more than the the Hubble distance, they are behaving independently of each other. Simply by causality, they don't know what the other point is doing. And therefore, you can describe them as totally separate universes. They evolve independently of each other. And if you're looking at the Hubble patch volume, which is of the order of the Hubble radius, then they should be well approximated by Freeman-Robertson-Walker universe. And so therefore, what you can do, if you have two points which are separated by much more than the Hubble radius, then you can just describe them using Freeman equation, two separate Freeman-Robertson-Walker universes. And I think the first people to use this idea were Salopek and Bond in 1990. And in this picture, you can easily calculate the curvature perturbation, because what it is just to start at some flat slice at the end of inflation. Inflation has made the universe flat. And curvature perturbation corresponds to variation of log the scale factor at constant energy density hypersurface or constant Hubble rate hypersurface. And so what so the curvature perturbation, you just look at some hypersurface at some, you choose some value of the Hubble rate H star and calculate the scale factor at that energy, and that gives you the curvature perturbation. And in particular, if you have, if your equation of state is just a function of the energy density, then you find that the curvature perturbation is conserved. And it's very easy to see that, because you can just write the curvature perturbation is just given as log A at some fixed value of H, calculate the derivative, d log a dh, and you find that it's a function of w only. And so if w only depends on energy density, the same as saying it depends only on h, then every point will, then there's no, you can just integrate this to find how much log a changes with age, and it's the same at every point, and therefore the curvature perturbation, which is the perturbation of log a between different points, it won't change. And so that means that whenever you have a unique equation of state for the system, then the curvature perturbation is conserved. You won't produce or you won't destroy any curvature perturbation in that. And that simplifies the calculation, because it means that, in principle, what we want to calculate, the curvature perturbation at the surface of blast scattering, because that's what we see when we look at the C and B some recombination. But, so what this means is that we can, we don't have to do the calculation all the way there, because we know that the curvature perturbation won't change if we have a unique equation of state. So we can stop the calculation as soon as we have that situation. And in particular, in the single field inflationary model, this is particularly straightforward, because as soon as the universe comes out of inflation, all the universes are identical, all have the same value of the field phi, because that's just when inflation ends, the field phi has some particular value at which the slower conditions fail. And so all the universes start from the same, the separate universes start from the same initial conditions, and they evolve in exactly the same way. And so in the single field case, curvature perturbation is conserved all the way from the end of inflation. And so therefore, you can push the time when you need to, where you want to calculate the curvature perturbation, you can push it from pre-combination all the way to the end of inflation. And so that means that all you need to do is to calculate variation of log A at constant phi at the end of inflation. And that gives you the usual form that it's minus h over phi dot and perturbation of the field. And so that way you find that the temperature power spectrum is related to the field power spectrum in this way. And you can, using the previous result, you can write it in this form. And this is what these experiments measure. So we know that is roughly 10 to minus 10. And so that gives us a constraint for the parameters of this. You can obviously calculate this from the potential. And so this is what you get in a single field case. You get a scale invariant spectrum, almost perfectly Gaussian perturbations, and very simple simple perturbations. However, at the moment, this is still perfectly compatible with observations. However, if this hints that there is FNL of order 50 or something like that, if they are true, then we have to do something else and modify this picture. And the simplest way to do that is to, well, I mean, you can do various things. You can change the kinetic term and so on. But one simple way to modify this is to assume that there is, in addition to the inflaton field, there is some other light scalar field around during inflation. And so I note that field by chi. And then during inflation, if the field is light, meaning that its mass is less than the Hubble rate, then it will behave in the same way as the inflaton fluctuations. It will develop a similar scale invariant spectrum of perturbations. The power spectrum of chi is approximately the same as the power spectrum of phi. And so it's given by that. And now, so if you look at this picture, then you no longer, these separate universes are identical because they have different value of chi at the end of inflation. And so now you have different evolution for different universes. When inflation ends, you then have some potentially non-equilibrium, potentially complicated evolution until your system reaches thermal equilibrium. And when your system is in thermal equilibrium, the equilibrium state is unique, and it doesn't remember the value of the field initially, if it's not a conserved quantity. And so therefore, by the time your universe thermalizes, so after it has thermalized, then the equilibrium state is unique, and the curvature perturbation is conserved from that point on. And so therefore, all you need to do is to calculate the curvature perturbation at some fixed energy after your universe has reached thermal equilibrium. You don't have to go all the way to recombination. Okay? And so that's basically what you then do in this separate universe picture. For each separate universe, you solve the Freeman equation coupled to the field equations. It gives a nonlinear system of coupled equations. And you pick some Hubble rate, which is below the Hubble rate at which the universe thermalizes. And you calculate scale factor at that energy, and that gives you the curvature perturbation. Now, of course, then it means that zeta, the curvature perturbation, depends on the two fields, the values of the two fields, the end of inflation. Those are the only things that are different in different universes. But as I already said, variations in phi essentially just mean that the universe ends, the inflation ends later or earlier in that universe than in the others. So they just correspond to these kind of trivial shifts in time, and they give the usual inflationary perturbations. And therefore, we don't have to worry about them. They have the same form as in the single field model. The new contribution comes from variations of chi, this other light field between different separate universes. And so what, yes?
Together, you said equilibration should erase differences in color.
Yeah.
Right. But on what scale, right? Isn't that an ongoing, and are there differences in chi that keep coming in the horizon?
No, because every point, so you should just think of, so chi, you're assuming that chi is not a conserved quantity. So
it's just some parameter. You imagine that at different, so you have two different universes which start in a different initial condition, but when they you let them evolve, they reach thermal equilibrium, then the thermal equilibrium has, as always, just have a creation of state that you calculate for that system in thermal equilibrium. So it doesn't have any memory of what the initial state was, except for the conserved quantities. And because this happens at every point, there isn't any long wavelength information other than what is stored in the local local variables. So it really, thermalization erases the information about these at every point, and therefore.
Yes, that's right. So
it's still going to have a perturbation spectrum as well.
Chi has a perturbation spectrum, yes.
So
and that will be important, but when you're looking
that's at. That's not what you're talking about being erased.
But yes, yeah, so when you look at a single Hubble patch, so the chi has some fluctuations over very long distance. This is a scaling invariant spectrum. However, when we look at the single Hubble patch, we don't see this. So for this calculation, we don't care about it. All we see is how the scale factor we calculate at the density depends on the local value of chi. That's all these equations, all a couple of Freeman and Field equations know. And so the value of chi will affect the scale factor, but it's purely a local process. But it's true, and it will become very important, it's true that chi, the initial values of chi are correlated over very long distances. And that leads to correlations in the scale factor and therefore in the Kerr-Russell perturbation. But it's the process by which it happens is purely local. So
chi is completely massless, or is
chi, it doesn't have to be completely massless. All it has to be lighter. The mass has to be less than the Hubble rate during inflation.
And how does it affect the Lagrangian?
Well, I haven't shown you any Lagrangian yet.
It affects the scale factor because it has some potential.
Yes, it has some interactions. Now, I'm being very general here. So therefore, we look at some examples later, but basically it's just the initial condition for the, it's a coupled system of two fields, which can have some complicated dynamics. But in general, if you change the initial conditions, the evolution changes. But the important point is evolution changes, but the final state doesn't change because it always reaches thermal equilibrium.
So you're also assuming that this guy doesn't change the coupling, so it's a relativistic definition going. I mean, if this guy affects the couplings from place to place, it can give rise to entropy perturbation too, right?
So what do you mean by chi affecting the couplings? So there are couplings and there are fields, and sort of separating them from each other. So the couplings are fixed. If they are not, then you just. There are certain constants in the Lagrange, and everything else is fields. So
I think you were saying, like, I mean, you have the entropy perturbations, but then you thermalize and all kicks in with the adiabatic.
That's right.
And that's the two combinations, the original adiabatic plus the entropy that became adiabatic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
No, it's just that, I mean, so you tell these field in vertices, so then new processes can happen.
Yes, I never think of that as an interaction between chi and the other fields. And yes, I'm assuming a perfectly general.
But even in the thermalization first. Mm.
Yes, no, that's
so
right.
So
that's.
So anybody on numbers
yes.
Depend on chi.
Yeah, so that's. Yes, yeah, so if. Yes, yeah, so I'm assuming that. The value of chi is not
conserved.
But I mean, the point is, if chi, the value of chi is not a conserved quantity, then it will be erased. When you reach a thermal equilibrium, the equilibrium state doesn't depend on value of any non-conserved quantity. I mean, that's just thermodynamics. And but the way in way by which you get to thermal equilibrium will depend on that, and depending on the initial value, state, get there faster or slower, and that's where the effect comes from.
So you're going to determine the dynamical time scale for the thermalization essentially numerically in your
yes, that's what I would do.
And you're going to have to constrain your interaction so it thermalizes in time?
So there are practical things. So I'm basically assuming that the interactions. So one thing I have to assume is that the interactions are strong enough so that the system thermalizes in some cosmologically meaningful time. Of course, for the actual calculations, I have to assume something much more, which is that the system thermalizes during my simulation, which means that the couplings can't be very weak. But in principle, you don't. So far, I haven't made that assumption. So what I'm just assuming is that at some time before the surface of last scattering, the fields equilibrate with thermal equilibrium, and then the memory of initial value of phi is lost. And so therefore, if that's the case, then you just need to know, if you look at some fixed energy after that, and calculate the scale factor there, and how it depends on the initial chi, and that gives you. And then you took in the whatever distribution, whatever spectrum chi had, and you can calculate the spectrum of energy. Now, in many cases, you can Taylor expand this, and so you have normal inflaton contribution here, and then you take the linear and quadratic terms. And if you assume that chi is initially Gaussian, then this will just give you another Gaussian contribution. This is just constant times the linear piece. And this will give you a non-Gaussian contribution. And so this is what normally we do perturbation theory would be essentially calculating this contribution. And once you have that Taylor expansion, then it's very easy to calculate that. Yeah, so you can essentially assume, there are
two different situations one can consider, either that this is the dominant linear term or this. Now because it is possible that the Gaussian perturbations we see are actually produced by this chi field. So this field is, if this term is much bigger than that, then you can just drop that and you have the same form as for the definition of FML, and therefore FML would be just the ratio of this to that squared. And so, and 5/6 is just conventional normalization for FML. And so in that case, so if this term is bigger, if the chi term is bigger than the phi term, then FNL would be just that ratio. Sorry. Yes. And the slightly more complicated case is when this term is small. So then you have the normal inflaton contribution giving the Gaussian perturbations. But on top of that, you may have a non-Gaussian contribution coming from that term. And then the FNL parameterization doesn't really apply because it's these phi and chi are not correlated, or at least they're not the same. And so therefore, you don't really have the constant FNL, but you can still calculate this ratio of three-point function to the power spectrum, and you find that this effective FNL is given by this kind of
different signs. So this is, I mean, just the ratio of this first, second term for first term, or the square of the first term. So, if chi dominates, that's FNL, isn't it?
Are you saying, I guess, n double prime?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I
think there may actually be a sign.
So this was calculated by Webaker and Blythe. Now, I'm not that. I actually have a feeling that they use a different sign convention for FNL, and this minus sign here is because of that. But so, for this case, because you're comparing a Gaussian field which is uncorrelated with a non-Gaussian, but you don't get just a constant FNL, but you get something more complicated, and you find that it's this number which is it's just two powers of the Schlödl parameters, and so it's a small number times the third power of the second derivative of n, times a log, where k is the physical Bayes number today, and H0 is the Hubble rate today. So basically, on the cosmological scale, this logarithm is of order 1. So, but on these two different cases,
you have very, very different expressions, but what it boils down to is that you need to calculate n as a function of chi, and you can then get FNL by plugging it into one of these expressions. Okay, and the simplest example of this kind of a system is the Curvaton model, where you have the field phi, which is the inflaton field, which has any potential. For this, it doesn't matter what it is, but you can take it to be m squared phi squared if you want. And I think actually for this particular analysis, it was 5 to the 4. But anyway, so you can do it for any inflationary potential, and then you have another scalar field chi, which has a small mass. So that during inflation it's light, but then after inflation h drops below m and becomes massive. And when it's massive, it behaves like matter, and therefore it affects the expansion of the universe. It's a matter component which varies from one separate universe to another because they have different densities, different initial values of chi. Now, of course, if you just had that, then the chi field would eventually dominate the energy density. It wouldn't look like our universe. So therefore, chi has to decay. And so the easiest way to do that is to put in a Yukawa coupling to some fermion. So that's where the thermalization in this case would come in. The chi particles would decay into standard model particles. And it happens in some finite time, which is just given by the perturbative decay rate gamma, can be calculated. And in this case, it's then very easy to calculate what the derivatives of n are, and in terms of the Curvaton ratio of the Curvaton density to the total energy density at the time when the particles decay, you find that the derivatives are of that form, and if you assume that the Curvaton also gives the Gaussian perturbations, you find this form for FNL is 5/3 times 1 over r. So essentially, you get the standard conclusion for gravitons that you can get high non-Gaussianity if the gravitation dominates, the contribution from the gravitation dominates the Gaussian perturbations, but is a very small subdominant part of the total energy at the time when they decay, if R decay is very small. Okay, so this is a simple perturbative example where,
then it would be in the end some sort of dark matter.
Yes, exactly. If this was a stable particle, you would end up in the universe which is just full of matter, or you could think of this as dark matter.
So, you have radiation and you have this matter, right?
Yes.
But isn't that an entropy perturbation in that case?
So
the inflaton has decayed into radiation. And then these
guys still there and matter, but in the conditions. But yes, so that's a different situation, because if chi is stable, then it is a concern.
Oh, but even if it is not stable, it will decay preferentially into some species. Okay, so
then there would be some conserved quantity. If there are different particle species that chi and phi decay into, then it would mean that there would have to be some conserved quantity.
Well, if it decays into some stable particle, you know, the number of those particles is a conserved quantity, I think, right?
Yes, but so then if it does that, then chi also carries the same charge. So if there isn't any conserved quantity, then they will decay, then chi and chi will decay into the same stuff eventually. Okay, so what I'm more interested in is when things don't happen as smoothly as in that case. So there we just had a
perturbative adiabatic, perturbative slow decay. But there are many situations in which you have non-equilibrium phenomena that would essentially turn, that would destroy these chi particles and turn them into radiation, equilibrate the system much faster. And different situations where this could happen are, you can have a preheating happening after inflation, or parametric resonance transfers the energy very rapidly from the inflaton to other degrees of freedom. The curvaton particle can decay through a resonance. So in preheating, the inflaton decays through a resonance. It can also be the curvaton particle, or you can have some phase transition, which, if the properties of the phase transition depend on the field chi, then that would give rise to cavity perturbations. You can think of brain collisions or ekbarotic bounds or whatever. Any non-equilibrium process that depends, whose details depend on the value of the field chi, and which destroys the field chi, can give you potentially high levels of non-Gaussianity, if you're talking about some non-linear non-equilibrium phenomenon, you wouldn't expect your function to be just some simple linear function, but you would expect there to be some non-linear dependence on chi. And the problem here is that because we are talking about non-equilibrium, non-linear phenomena, normal perturbative methods fail. And so you can't just do perturbation theory to second order and hope to get the correct answer. So we need to do something else. And the alternative, essentially, that I will be following is to solve the coupled Friedmann and field equations numerically. And the first people, my knowledge, who tried this were Bruce Bassett and Tanaka, who looked at a particular model known as a massless preheating, which is an example of a preheating model. So you have an inflaton phi with quadratic potential, and it's coupled to some other field chi. So during inflation, and then you have a resonance which transfers energy from pi to chi very quickly and thermalizes the system.
Quantum mechanics, right?
Yes.
The classically, you cannot get there.
Yes, that's right. I'll perhaps come back to that later. However, that is a good point, and so we can't wait until we are really in thermal equilibrium. However, what is enough is that we have to run our simulation long enough so that the equation of state is no longer dependent on the initial conditions. And that generally happens faster than the real thermalization. And the simple reason for that is that, for instance, if you think of matter or radiation, the equation of state doesn't actually depend on the particle distribution. It only depends on the properties of the particles. So as long as the part, you can think of the particles as a weakly interacting gas, then they have a well-defined unique equation of state. So you don't actually need to achieve full thermalization, but some kind of a quasi-equilibrium state is enough. But that is a very important point. Okay, so in this case, we start in bus values of phi, which inflates, then starts inflation ends, starts to oscillate, units of radiation dominated. Now this oscillation, because it's coupled to chi, there's a resonance, it starts to resonate. If you
write it in terms of conformal time and rescale the fields, find that the equation of motion for the inhomogeneous modes of chi looks like this, where this is just the co-moving wave number rescaled by something, and you have a periodic function on the stochastic cosine as a sort of a driving force, as always for this kind of, so this is known as a Lamé equation, but basically the point is that if you have this kind of an equation which has a periodic, where the constant the sort of mass term has periodic time dependence, then satisfy the condition of the Floquet theorem, which tells you that the solutions have an exponential form, either real or imaginary exponent. If you have a real exponent, then you have a resonance, you have an exponentially growing solution. And here is the resonance band structure for this equation in terms of the wave number and the ratio of the couplings. The orange things here are the resonance bands where it's growing exponentially. Don't worry about these lines here. Okay, so the details of this don't really matter too much, except that there is what the resonance does is that it transfers energy very rapidly from the inflaton field to chi. It happens in a microscopic time scale, much faster than for any perturbative process. Now, what Bassett and Tanaka then did, took this system, wrote under homogeneous equations without gradient terms, couple them to Riemann equation. Now you have a nonlinear system of equations which you can solve numerically. Because you don't have the inhomogeneous modes there, you're not actually describing any sub-horizon dynamics. You're not describing what happens inside the horizon. So there's a sort of a weak point there, but you can still try to do this. The problem with that is that the system doesn't really ever equilibrate. It doesn't reach thermal equilibrium. So it's a little bit a tricky thing to do. You don't know exactly when you can measure the curvature perturbation, but anyway, you can try, and that's what they found. Basically, they found is that so this is the this is log A, this is the curvature perturbation as a function of initial value of chi, and it varies very short. So this is just the same result on two different scales. So it doesn't have this smooth form as we assumed. It's not linear plus quadratic. Suyama and Yokoyama studied the same model a few years later and essentially found the same result. And what they looked at it in a little bit more detail, and they found that it's essentially a chaotic system, which is not surprising when you have nonlinear coupled oscillators, you have chaotic phenomena. And that's what's happening here. And therefore, you have sensitive dependence on the initial conditions. You can see this is the same result with increased resolution. This is more data points here, and you can see that when you try to look at these peaks more closely, you see more and more structure. So it looks like a fractal. So it's essentially chaotic behavior. However, as I already mentioned, there's a problem with this approach, and that is that we know that for this system, inhomogeneous modes are important because they are coupled to inhomogeneous modes of chi are coupled to phi, and they are amplified. If you look at the resonance band, so this is the wave number, and they only included k equals zero for the axis here. But there are lots of modes, inhomogeneous modes, which are also amplified by the resonance, and which could play an important role. And so what we did to take that into account was simply the same as we had in talk this morning. To do a lattice field theory, include the gradient terms in the equations of motion. It has two scalar fields, and then the Riemann equation with average energy density, and put these on the lattice and solve it.
Question. So you're doing that classic. So put the resonant things as quantum mechanics.
Okay. Yes. That's a very good point.
But why is the resonance quantum mechanical?
Well, it's that classically, but I mean, you're saying quantum particle reduction.
And it is because if you just had a classical field. But basically, if you are assuming that each of these separate universes is homogeneous, if there are homogeneous classical fields, then you don't have, then the initial value for any of these homogeneous nodes is zero, and it would not resonate, it wouldn't grow. So, okay, so the picture is the same as before, except that now each of the separate universes consists of lots of points, which is called the lattice, and the lattices with different initial values of chi, and by chi I mean the average over the whole lattice, and that's determined by the frozen long wavelength modes at the end of the inflation. And so this picture still, now because we are putting in the lattice, we have to be a little bit more careful about length scales, but essentially this should be fine if our dynamical scales, the relevant length scale of the physics, is smaller than the co-moving lattice size. And if our lattice, so if that's not the case, then we are not describing the local dynamics correctly. Then the lattice must be smaller than the horizon size, because otherwise we can't assume that the lattice has Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. We can't assume that it's homogeneous if it's much bigger than the horizon. And the wavelengths that we are interested in have to be much longer than the horizon size. But that's fine because we are interested in scales that are observable now, and they are
hugely bigger than the horizon size. Yes, L is the size of the box, yes. So basically I want my L to be smaller than the horizon, but bigger than the length scale of in interesting physics. Right, so now we get to this quantum point. So obviously, we need to somehow introduce this quantum element, and it is done through initial conditions. And what we do is we put in classical ensemble of initial conditions, which are the same statistical two-point function as the quantum two-point function of quantum vacuum fluctuations. So just at three levels, just 1/2 omega or any given mode. And the nice thing about this is that at linearized level, if you take these initial conditions, the linear equations, then and you calculate statistical expectation values, you get the same answers as for quantum expectation values in a quantum theory. So at linearized level, this is equivalent to quantum theory. And at nonlinear level, obviously it's not. But when things become highly nonlinear, as they do very quickly in our case, then in fact, we know from experience that classical approximation is generally very good for anything nonlinear, simply because in order for things to become nonlinear for a weakly coupled system, you need high occupation numbers, and then you have classical values.
I'm putting in classical fluctuations which have this two-point function. Now this is just the two-point function of quantum fluctuations. So
yeah, but you're just fixing the amplitude. I mean, all I'm saying is that there's a difference between quantum two-point function and classical.
Yeah, but they just happen to give the same answer. If you put in these initial conditions and then do a linearized calculation, linearized classical evolution, at any later time, you find the same as for the linearized quantum. So of course it doesn't make it a quantum system, but at linear theory you don't see the difference. You have to look at interactions to see the difference.
Maybe one way to think about it is that these modes have already exited and then are re-entering the horizon, so they already become classical when they.
These modes are inside.
Yeah, but they're inside the horizon now. But maybe like in the past, they've exited the horizon and then come back.
No. During the simulation, they are inside the horizon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But the simulation is done after inflation has ended.
Well, that's right.
So if you go back in time, some of them might exit the horizon.
Some of them might have, but yes, no, that's...
So the Andrew's point is that those are the ones that you can treat classically, the ones that have always been inside the horizon, even during inflation, never exited.
Yes, yes, I'm not claiming any other classical behavior except that the expectation values calculated from the two distributions are the same.
Yeah, I guess I'm just quibbling because, it's factors of I and stuff. Like that in the quantum thing, you've got many different two-point functions.
And you expect that at the level of two-point functions, you can have the same, you get exactly the same results here.
Okay, what you're saying is that beta coefficient, starting from vacuum state, it grows in the same way as the amplitude of this mode with this initial amplitude.
Yeah. Yes. The linearized quantum calculation is the same.
Well, I guess so. We normally say that the Kolmogorov coefficient is very large. That's the classic.
And so when you have very large, then it's that. But so for
okay, so we're in a sort of space.
there are two regimes where these approximations should be good, and if when these are linear, then they are higher numbers. Okay, I guess I should move on. So they did verse some simulation and linear. Bit embarrassing because we got this nice result. So this is M of the
Perturbator perturbase is a function of chi, and we find this nice smooth quadratic form. However, it actually turned out that we had a numerical error there, and that's where all this nice smooth behavior came from. And so these guys corrected the error, and they found this, and we agree with them. We corrected our code, and so now this has been calculated with three different algorithms, and they all agree. And so this is the curvature perturbation as a function of chi. And you can see that it has this horrendously complicated structure. And this is the thing whose first and second derivatives you were meant to calculate in order to calculate F and L. And so clearly it doesn't look good. And I mean, there seems to be still the chaotic behavior left that was seen in the homogeneous calculations. So here is for comparison the earlier results, and essentially it shares many of those features. And so one lesson from this is that for this kind of a system, just count two perturbations. There is no way you could get this by looking at small perturbations in chi. It's just extremely nonlinear. But then the other question is, what do you do with this? Because if you can't calculate F and L, how do you compare this with the data? And so one thing these guys try to do is to sort of smear the peaks. And I mean, there's perhaps some justification for that. You wouldn't see all of this structure, you see some kind of average behavior. And so if you average over the fluctuations of chi within one horizon, you get this red curve here. And that you can fit nicely with the quadratic. You get this answer. And that would correspond to FNL of roughly 10,000, which is well above the observational bounds. So if this way of interpreting the data and comparing it with observations is correct, it is not at all clear. If it is, then it would actually say that in this case, you get the non-Gaussianity is much higher than allowed by the data. Sorry.
This is on all scales. I mean, it has this logarithmic behavior. So, but yes, so F and L in this case would. So essentially, F and L would really be 10,000 times log K over. So it has a logarithmic dependence on scale, but this is roughly what it would be in cosmological scales. The other thing to do, other thing one can do.
But there must be some free parameter for LFT squared over lambda or something. Right? I mean, because the contribution of these chi perturbations could be negligible, is that?
Yes, there's one free parameter in these models, and that's the coupling of the two fields, so that's G. So there is a
so if you make that small, then this could
if
be
you big. If you make that if you make so yeah, and then that's right, it's an important thing because if you move that outside the resonance bands, we haven't got data for what happens. So this is in the middle of a resonance band. That's perhaps the maximum that you can.
I mean, this means that the quadratic contribution is just as big as the linear contribution, right?
Because well, yes.
The time minus 5, yes. You're saying that this goes away?
Absolutely true, yes. It's, so you shouldn't think of that as a...
So it's just completely non-Gaussian.
Yeah, and when you actually look at it, it's even worse than having f and l equals 10,000. It's not a quadratic function, it's something... So it's, and you can see it from here. The amplitude of the cavity perturbations is 10 to minus 5, which corresponds to that. That's the scale here. So in fact, the amplitude of these peaks is much bigger than the amplitude of the cavity perturbations. Mm-hmm. But then the question is, yeah, how? So this is probably not the correct way to compare this with the data, but it's really hard to see what one should do. What they argued is that perhaps these peaks would correspond to some kind of cold spots, because they all are positive and they correspond to lower temperature. And so you would expect to see cold spots on the CMB. But really what you should do is to take this and really compare this directly with the data rather than going through intermediate quantities. Okay, right. I'll very quickly mention another piece of work, another application for this. I already mentioned the Curbaton model, which is a perturbative Curbaton. The Curbaton decays perturbatively. Now we can do a very similar thing and couple the Curbaton chi to another scalar field sigma and have resonance between them
and do a similar calculation. There's certain technical issues there because the massless preheating model, the reason why everyone has studied that is that it has very simple properties which makes the simulations easier. When you look at other models, you have to work a little bit harder. But anyway, essentially what we do is we do first the first part of the evolution using linear theory, then have the lattice simulation, and then again use the sort of effective description after that. So what you do is you can calculate. If you did it directly, you would just measure the derivatives of M, but because of what we do, it gets a little bit more complicated. We measure those quantities, and from those we can calculate M prime. And what we find for the curvaton is again that it gets much less Gaussian. So this is a function of the initial field value. This is the perturbative prediction for FNL, which is just 5/3 times 1 over r. And for the resonant decay, we find again this kind of irregular dependence on the parameters, but the whole thing is a much higher level. So again, we get numbers which are of this order. Okay, so yeah, so what we then did here is there are two free parameters. Once you fix these, there are still two free parameters left. There's the field value, and then there is the lifetime of the curvaton. And we fixed the lifetime of the curvaton in such a way that the amplitude of the Gaussian term is the same as the observations. So that's how determine this parameter. So the amplitude of the amplitude of the Gaussian piece is just 10 to minus 5. And so again, we find that this is as big as the linear term. So that was the whole story. So I've shown how one can calculate curvature perturbations produced by non-equilibrium physics in a non-linear way using field theory simulations. And in principle, this could be applied to any system. So if someone can tell me what effective field theory to use for the ekpyrotic bounds, then I can do this for that as well. Perhaps the most important lesson that one should learn from this is that things can become highly non-linear, as this shows. So when you are talking about non-linear, non-equilibrium phenomena, then simple perturbative methods simply wouldn't work. You can't find that structure using perturbation theory. And so the things are complicated. What we found in both cases for the preheating and the Curvaton resonance is that we get non-Gaussianity, which is at a level which is well above the observational bounds, and indeed so high that the non-Gaussian contribution is at the same level as the Gaussian, the linear term. Okay, thank you very much.
So does the occupation number remain large through the simulation?
Yes, I mean that's partly because the couplings in both of these cases are very small, and that's generally in place value models. What makes them so nice for these kind of calculations is that inflation requires the coupling to be extremely small. And so in order for things to become non-linear, the occupation number has to be is one of the square root of the coupling. And so if the coupling, as in the inflation number, is generated 10 to minus 14, it means that the occupation numbers that you're talking about are for a million. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, in this case, the classical approximation should be pretty good.
Questions? Well, I guess one thing you may wonder is that if quantum effects were to smooth this peaks. I don't know if that's...
Sorry, what?
Quantum effects would have smooth this peaks. So...
You have to be more...
Well, you can, of course... Because, you know, we are not including all quantum effects. So yes, you could...
But no, your quantum effects are only in the initial conditions, right?
Yes.
So but the thing is that at the end, to reach a thermal state, you need quantum mechanics. Your occupation number eventually should
reach one. That's right. But then it would mean that the quantum effects happening at late time somehow have to erase the structure that was generated before that.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, you can't be sure. Quantum mechanics is funny. We, of course, can't be empirical. What one could do, I mean, there are certain other approaches. One can try to simulate a non-equilibrium quantum field theory using other kinds of methods which are not based on the classical approximation, which have other problems, but it's purely quantum mechanical. And so I guess the thing to do would be to repeat this using such a method and see if the same structure would still be there. I mean, those methods generally don't describe nonlinear phenomena very well, but at least you could then try to compare. If they don't agree, you have to figure out which one of them is wrong.
You mean NPI methods?
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, methods with 2PI effective action bounds. Yeah, so methods that are based on the effective actions.
And what goes wrong? You say things go, they don't describe nonlinear things well. What's the generic problem?
Well, so there is a basically, I mean, they are essentially, it's a resummation of perturbation theory. And I mean, I've been trying to do this. And it seems that things break down when the occupation number reaches the classical level. So it's basically because you're still trying to essentially do perturbations here, even though you are really summing it. So when things become highly nonlinear, your expansion parameter becomes one, and then it fails. It may be possible to find some example where it would work, and then it would be interesting.
Okay, let's thank Arthur again.